From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a version of Batman, informed by Clint Eastwood, Mickey Spillane, and Nietzsche. We talk with comic book artist and writer Frank Miller. His Batman is a brooding, tortured vigilante. Miller recreated the superhero for his graphic crime novels, The Dark Knight Returns, and his recent sequel, The Dark Knight Strikes Again. Also, we meet B-movie actor Bruce Campbell. He starred in Sam Raimi's mock horror films, The Evil Dead and Army of Darkness. He's also had roles on television in Xena, Warrior Princess, and Hercules. He has a memoir. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Far From Heaven, the new movie by Todd Haynes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says he's convinced that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Rumsfeld was reacting to Iraq's assertion in a letter to the United Nations that it has no such weapons and that weapons inspections will prove that. The secretary declined to answer questions about whether Iraq may already be in breach of the latest UN resolution by lying about its weapons. The resolution specifies that Iraq must declare all such weapons to UN weapons inspectors or face serious consequences. Rumsfeld said the letter should be analyzed in its original Arabic to determine exactly what it says. The House has rejected legislation that would have made it harder for consumers to avoid paying their debts by filing for bankruptcy. With Congress close to final adjournment, the bill appears dead. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
87 Republicans defected and voted with most of the Democrats, killing a procedural motion to consider the bankruptcy bill. A large and well-funded coalition of financial interests has lobbied for the bill for 5 years. Consumer groups and organized labor said the bill would punish poor and middle-class families. This time around, both chambers of Congress passed the bill. Negotiators even ironed out differences between the two versions. But anti-abortion Republicans in the House objected to the compromise. They said one version was unfair to protesters who were fined for demonstrating outside abortion clinics. House Republican leaders couldn't bridge the gap between business conservatives and social conservatives, and the bill failed. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of State Colin Powell says the U.S. is seeking to halt free oil shipments to North Korea. Karen Kelly reports from Ottawa.
Colin Powell says the United States will no longer pay for monthly shipments of oil to North Korea. The U.S. is halting the aid in response to news that North Korea is operating a nuclear program in violation of a 1994 treaty. Speaking to reporters in Ottawa, Powell said the U.S. will allow the current shipment to go ahead.
We believe it was appropriate and prudent to send in this shipment, which is already on the high seas, with the understanding that we cannot continue to provide fuel in this manner in light of North Korean violation of the understanding.
Powell said American officials are seeking support on this issue from the European Union, South Korea, and Japan. Officials in Seoul and Tokyo have expressed fears that the move may prompt North Korea to retaliate. For NPR News, I'm Karen Kelly in Ottawa.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 143 points, or 1.7%, to close at 8,542 in heavy trading. Advancing issues led declines by more than 2-1. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 50 points, or 3.7%. It closed at 1,411. This is NPR News. Hospitals in four major American cities are trying to determine whether to tighten security in the face of a purported terrorist threat. The FBI passed along a warning that attacks against hospitals have been threatened in Chicago, Houston, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. The White House said it regards the credibility of the threat as very low. The FBI said it prefers to err on the side of caution in making the information public. Authorities served 17 search warrants in the Los Angeles and Las Vegas areas today in a multiple homicide investigation targeting the record label of the late rap star Tupac Shakur. Eric Roy reports from member station KCRW.
A Los Angeles County Sheriff's SWAT team and anti-gang officers surrounded the headquarters of the controversial rap music label The Row Records, once known as Death Row Records, before detectives went in searching for evidence. Deputy Sheriff Sonia Parra says the raid started before dawn.
Beverly Hills, which is the office of Marion Knight. He's not a suspect at this time.
Also known as Suge Knight, the rap mogul was with Tupac Shakur when he was gunned down in Las Vegas in 1996. Deputy Pata would not say if that's what detectives are investigating, nor if they're probing the murder of rival rapper Notorious B.I.G., who was later shot in Los Angeles. Pata says there were other raids in L.A. and one in Las Vegas today. Nevada authorities were advised but did not take part. Several people have been arrested. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
The World Bank confirmed today that Argentina has failed to pay more than $800 million that was due today. The World Bank said it will cut off access to existing loans if the Argentine government doesn't pay the debt in full in 30 days. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Procter & Gamble, makers of Metamucil wafers, available in two cookie flavors, apple crisp and cinnamon spice, to help maintain regularity. Metamucil.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. It's been 10 years since Batman was last sighted on the streets of Gotham City. Crime runs rampant in the streets, and Bruce Wayne is still tortured by the memories of his parents' murders. As the city suffers through a heat and violent crime wave, the nation at large wages war against its neighbors. Civil society is crumbling, and deep in the Batcave, the aging, bitter, caped crusader decides to let loose his pent-up rage. So begins comic book writer and artist Frank Miller's 1985 graphic crime novel, Batman: The Dark Knight Returns, about the comeback of one of the comic book genre's oldest and most popular superheroes. One Rolling Stone critic says of the book, "In Miller's hands, Batman is bigger than a comics icon. He's a violent symbol of American disillusion and American idealism." Miller has worked with DC Comics, where Batman originated, throughout his career. He was also the writer and artist for the Marvel comic series Daredevil and is the author of the crime story series Sin City. Now Miller has a sequel to his first Batman novel called Batman: The Dark Knight Strikes Again. When you first returned to the idea of making a new Batman, what kinds of questions did you ask yourself about how to make Batman relevant to what's going on in the world now? And was that the challenge you did set for yourself?
That was part of it. I've never found this sort of material irrelevant. It lends itself so much, especially to political humor, that I'm amazed at how little it's used that way. The first Dark Knight was a response to the Reagan era with the in the 80s with its excesses, and now we are in such a strange period that having this mythic figure waltzing through our crazy politics just seemed natural.
So, what kinds of questions did you ask yourself? For instance, what kind of world would be scary enough that you'd need a Batman?
I've never really had to ask myself that question. All I've had to do is read the newspaper. Because it's a scary world getting scarier. But I guess the biggest question I have to ask myself is why these characters were ever created in the first place. And for that, you have to go back to the late 30s and wonder why two Jewish kids in Ohio created Superman, which was the start of all this superhero stuff. And if you look at it, it was a time of rabid anti-Semitism, not just abroad, but domestically. And it's kind of amazing. It was a bit of creative jujitsu that these kids, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, took the term Superman, which was obviously adored by Hitler, and used it to represent a golem that worked against corrupt landlords and was very much an anti-war figure in his early incarnations. It wasn't until the 40s, when war fever hit, that he became a flag waver. Up until then, he was much more a Superman working for the common man. So from the beginning, these characters were political in their nature.
Is this the Batman that you knew reading the original series?
Not exactly, no. I kind of remade him to make him more interesting. See, I had this terrible thing happen when I was 29 years old. I realized I was about to turn 30 and Batman was 29. And that meant I'd be older than Batman. And I just couldn't stand that thought. So I had to make him older. And everything else kind of sprang from that.
Just so people listening who weren't into comics as a kid and don't know the whole Batman story, could you fill us in?
Oh, the beginning of Batman is one of the best and the simplest to tell. He was a six-year-old boy coming home with his parents. A mugger shot them both to death. And he happened to be a very wealthy man, so as time went by, he trained himself to fight crime and became the best guy at weapons and science and everything else, and took on the image of a bat as his emblem against crime.
So he wasn't like a lot of the other Marvel comic superheroes who were, you know, Spider-Man was bitten by a spider, a radioactive spider. He simply had this psychological origin.
That's right. He's the one major character who he's almost the self-help hero, in that he simply made himself into something superior, and went after all the bad guys.
You know, as a kid, when you read about this guy, who the superhero dressed like a bat, you just really swallow it whole. You think, oh, sure, he gets to be a superhero and dress up. Cool. But when you think about it, what kind of guy would dress up like a bat? You know,
what you just said, Barbara, is a lot of where I come from at this. I when I handle these superheroes, I like to step back and take a look at them and go, what kind of person would really do this? What kind of person would dress up like a bat and throw people through windows? And I looked at what they'd done with the character, and he spent so much time being deputized and being this nice guy and God forbid, a role model for kids. And I realized, no, this would be a very, very strange man. And I don't think he'd be a pretty nice person to be around. So he'd be the guy you'd want to have when you're threatened by a criminal, but you probably wouldn't want to have dinner with him.
Now, part of what's depressing Batman, he's haunted by the loss of Robin in The Dark Knight. Yeah. What happened to Robin? And then you can tell us who your new Robin was.
Well, in the first Dark Knight, the most recent Robin had died in combat under circumstances that are never explained. So Batman was Robinless all these years. But when he goes back into action, a young girl named Carrie Kelly is inspired by him coming back into action to announce to the world that she is Robin, and goes out into action and learns on the road and eventually hooks up with Batman. She's a fun character. I fell in love with her right in her.
Yeah, why a girl? What were you going for with that?
Why not?
Sure.
It's such a boys' club in superhero land. And the women, when they show up, are bunnies. I mean, they're pale imitations of the heroes, but they're really busty. And I thought the idea, especially of a Robin who's a 13-year-old girl, was just adorable, and especially her being a gymnast, it all fit together really well.
One thing about your writing, the dialogue, there's a lot of really hard-boiled crime novel type lines in these books, and in all your series. And I'm thinking specifically of The Dark Knight, of when Batman's kicking around a thug he's trying to get information out of, and the guy's already all beaten up, and Batman throws him through a window, and the thug is screaming, "I got rights!" And Batman says, "You've got rights. Lots of rights. Sometimes I count them just to make myself feel crazy." That is great stuff.
Thanks.
Well, what are your models for that kind of
noir? I don't know. I was probably channeling Clint Eastwood with that particular rant. But when I was about 12 years old, I stopped reading comic books and started reading things like Mickey Spillane and later Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. Crime fiction is my favorite stuff. I love the hard-boiled stuff. And most of what I've done in the past 10 years has been hard-boiled crime stuff. And what I like to do is bring it to the superhero. When I first came to New York when I was 19 years old and trying to break into comics, I showed up with a whole bunch of samples of my artwork. Being an idiot, I hadn't looked at a comic book in years. But I had all these comics that I wanted to do. And they were all about tough guys in trench coats and vintage cars and great-looking women and guns. And I was just told that they didn't do that sort of thing. They only did guys in tights. So I had to learn how to draw guys in tights. And as soon as I got to do it on a regular basis and write my own stuff, I made the guys in tights function just like Mike Hammer. But I just wanted to bring a more urban edge to what was going on that had been missing for a while. It's not like I brought it in for the first time, all the way back to Steve Ditko and Spider-Man. There was a very New York urban edge, especially to Marvel Comics.
Now, speaking of urban edge, two gang members, characters in Dark Knight, Rob and Don.
Yes.
They speak this amazing slang. Yeah. I don't even know how to describe it. Maybe it's hip-hop kind of. I don't know what they're saying half the time. They say things like, my mon licking chegs, all lines are busy. Chegs, kind of my nasty Rob. I'm literally reading this from your book. Ears only, spud, as in members. What is this? I mean, what are they? What? I can't even parse it.
Yeah, my mon licking chegs. The whole thing actually comes by way of Lynn Varley and her brothers.
Lynn Varley is your colorist.
Yes.
And also your wife, right?
That's right, yes. It was a way that they spoke in their neighborhood in Livonia, Michigan. I know it sounds kind of hip-hop, but the source is so Anglo it's ridiculous. But it's simply a reverse way of speaking in pattern that I combined with some of the other stuff that's been going on more recently. And I mean, I wanted to create that sense of unfamiliarity that people have with youth speak in general. And since it was a story set in the future, it seemed like a natural to use this, you know, speech pattern that I was hearing.
So it's kind of a pigeon. I mean, it doesn't really make sense.
Oh, it does make sense. It's got its own grammar, as a matter of fact. It's almost all in reversals. You know, figure I won't means I will.
Okay.
Figure is always a negative.
And ears only, spud?
Yeah, spud is basically a put down, and ears only, as in members, means only members can hear it.
Gotcha.
It's pretty twisted, but it does make its own sense.
My guest is Frank Miller. His remakes of the Batman comics, The Dark Knight Returns and The Dark Knight Strikes Again, are now available in hardback. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with writer and artist Frank Miller. His recreation of the Batman comics are called The Dark Knight Returns and The Dark Knight Strikes Again. I read a really interesting comment that you made about the challenge of drawing comics, and that is that you said a lot of your job is to slow the reader's eye down in order to make you linger. What do you mean by that?
I really do believe that my biggest enemy with my job is time. Because technically, I could hand you one of my comics and you could absorb the entire thing, or at least go through the entire thing, go through the action of reading it in an extremely short amount of time, in 10 minutes. And I want you to take a half an hour or so. And so a lot of the tricks in my bag are ways to slow that act down. There are obvious and clumsy ones, like putting a lot of words in, which generally bores somebody to tears, or putting so many images in that it just takes that long to get through it. But the best ways are to make, first off, the story so compelling that you don't want to miss anything. I'm obsessed with pacing, so I'll often try to jockey, you know, large images against small ones and fairly dense blocks of text against light ones, because I don't have the advantage of a filmmaker. A filmmaker can leave the camera there for as long as he wants, and unless you want to leave the theater, you're pretty much stuck with his pacing. In my case, I've got a reader to fight all the time.
You know, there's something very sexy about how you draw. These superheroes, especially in the fight scenes, they have these you know, extended limbs, the leaping, the classic. But yet, something is different about the movement in your drawing.
Mm-hmm.
It really has a feeling of movement and a modern feeling of movement. I mean, do you watch people dance? Do you draw from life in some way to inspire you in the art?
I look a lot at what's going on in pop culture, especially now because it's a really fun time for it. The fashion scene is, especially the young fashion scene, is exploding with all kinds of interesting photography and clothing styles and just outrageous stuff in places like Tank Magazine, for instance. When it comes to the dance stuff, no, I'm not a big dance fan. I learned a lot from martial arts movies. And I ended up studying Bruce Lee movies and all of that, and ended up studying an awful lot of the samurai and the, you know, the Japanese and Chinese martial arts movies. And there's a real ballet to the way they do the combat.
When did you start drawing comics? How young were you?
I really don't remember that far back. I was probably between 5 and 6. I just always wanted to do it.
And how did you learn the basics? Did you get any formal artistic training?
Some people would argue I never did. I never had any formal training. I started visiting New York when I was 16 or 17. And an established artist who's still in the field, Neil Adams, would let me come into his studio and show him my portfolio. And he would always explain to me why I didn't have a chance and why my stuff was terrible. And then he'd give me some more lessons. And I'd go back home and work off those. So mostly I learned by finding the right books to study and taking a couple stray life drawing classes, but it was mostly school of hard knocks.
Often when people are self-taught, there's a huge gap somewhere that they get caught, a gap in their knowledge. Did you ever experience that once you did get a job writing at Marvel?
Gap in what sense?
In that you just never learned, like, to draw hands or...
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, it's when I start a new series, I often have to figure out, okay, how am I going to figure out how to draw this now? I've dodged this for years. When I started my Sin City series, I went, there's no dodging anymore. I've got to learn how to draw cars. Because I've been drawing boxes. I've been drawing, like, little lunch boxes with wheels on them for everything up until then. And so I got advice from an artist friend, Jeff Darrow, who led me to the die-cast metal cars you can buy. That way I could draw them three-dimensionally. I'd draw an angle I wanted. It's like having the power of a god or something, you know. And the more I drew them, the more I realized that they were as much characters as the people were. I eventually fell in love with drawing cars. Part of what makes my job so fun is these stopping points where I run into something I've never drawn before. Or I rediscover how to draw it. You can spend a long time drawing comic books and never really know what a shoe is. And then comes the day when you take your shoe off and put it on your drawing board and really discover what a weird thing a shoe is. Normal things look much more strange than we remember them.
Really simple question. Do you write first and then draw?
Mm-hmm.
Since you do both.
No, that's not such a simple question. It's a good question because it's different from artist to artist. I plot first. Obviously, it's sort of like I draw in pencil before I draw in ink. You have to have your story together. And what I tend to do is I have Post-it notes up against my wall blocking out a story. And when it's in good enough shape, I have my scenario ready. After that, I often simply start laying out the pages and drawing them in pencil. And as I do that, as I lay it out and as I draw on the boards themselves, I tend to write an awful lot down the borders. Just as I'm drawing, lines occur to me, new scenes occur to me, and so on. But I usually have the entire thing laid out before there's a formal script done. And then I produce a script, and then I letter it on the boards.
We're facing a war with Iraq now. We're facing terrorist threats. Are you dealing with those kinds of issues in the projects you're developing now?
Right now, it's my subject. I don't know how long that's going to be the case, but I feel a little bit like some of my predecessors must have felt after Pearl Harbor. For me, the timing was very peculiar because I was halfway through the second chapter of Dark Knight 2, which means I was right in the middle of the series, and I had just had Batman crash a flying Batmobile into a skyscraper and also had a giant bomb go off in Metropolis when 9/11 came around. So I was stuck midway through my series with something that was a little beyond resonant and downright creepy. And I talked it over with DC. They left it up to me, and I said, let's leave it as it is, and I'll write through this. But then it was then that I knew that I really had had to find my own way as a pop fiction guy to respond to what had happened and to the new world that had been revealed. So, yeah, stories are going to either directly or metaphorically have something to do with the war on terror for a long time to come, I think.
9/11 must have been so strange for you, having had this apocalyptic vision and used the image of the Twin Towers in your comics, and then to have this come true.
It was very strange to wake up in the morning and realize for the first time in my career that I didn't know what my next book was going to be, because all the plans I had seemed, well, not just trivial, but irrelevant. Like, I was, these fantasies don't exist in their own little dimension. They're everything is metaphor for something that's real. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that old science fiction movie, was a pop culture reaction to the communist threat. But this is how pop culture works: is that we process things and then turn them into a product that is at once more palatable, but deeply resonant. And I think it's going to be a while before pop culture does that with 9/11 and what seems to amount to World War III. So I was at sea for a while, and the first works I'm going to do are going to be very abrupt, directly addressing the terrorist thing in pulpy terms, in adventure terms. After that, I don't know where I'm going to go. It's a fascinating and terrifying time in more ways than one.
Frank Miller, it was really fun to talk with you. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
Frank Miller's remakes of the Batman comics, The Dark Knight Returns and The Dark Knight Strikes Again, have just come out in hardback. Miller's now working on the screenplay for the new Batman movie. The illustration style of his book, The Dark Knight Returns, was the inspiration for Tim Burton's Batman. I'm Barbara Bogave. This is Fresh Air, and here's a song from the film. This is Prince.
Life after we will see. So I can't go like a jerk, systematic overthrow of the humble class. Hollywood conjures images of the past. New world needs spirituality that will last. I've seen the future and it will be. I've seen the future and it will be.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing nearly 3 million members with customer-focused financial strategies and service. Online at thrivent.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Parachute Infantry, an American paratrooper's memoir of D-Day and the fall of the Third Reich, by David Kenyon Webster, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, really good, bad movie making. We talk with B-movie actor Bruce Campbell. He starred in Sam Raimi's mock horror cult films, The Evil Dead and Army of Darkness. The two met in high school. Campbell's memoir is now out in paperback. Also, David Edelstein reviews Far From Heaven, the new movie by Todd Haynes.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. There are many kinds of success in Hollywood. You can win all the Oscars like Tom Hanks, or command huge salaries like Tom Cruise and Harrison Ford, or make a stunning comeback in mid-career like John Travolta. And then you could spend years of your life covered in fake blood and chicken guts chasing down she-witches and delivering lines like, "Give me some sugar, baby." That's been the path of my guest, Bruce Campbell, the jutting chin star of such unforgettable mock horror vomitorium comedies as The Evil Dead, The Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness, all directed by Sam Raimi. You might also recognize Bruce Campbell for his television roles in the popular series Xena, Warrior Princess, and Hercules, which he also directed for 5 years. Campbell's memoir, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor, is now out in paperback. Let's listen to this clip from Army of Darkness, the last in the Evil Dead series. In this scene, the hero, Ash, played by Bruce Campbell, recaps the convoluted story of the previous two films.
It seems an archaeologist had come to this remote place to translate and study his latest find. Necronomicon Ex Mortis, the Book of the Dead. Found in human flesh and inked in blood, this ancient Sumerian text contained bizarre burial rites, funerary incantations, and demon resurrection passages. It was never meant for the world of the living. The book awoke something dark in the woods. It took Linda. And then it came for me. It got into my hand and it went bad. So I lopped it off at the wrist.
We could go on, but I think that's enough. So what the heck is that all about, Bruce Campbell? Did you ever actually follow the plot of these movies as you were making them?
Yeah, it only takes about 30 seconds to figure it out. it really, you know, when we, I met Sam Raimi in high school in 1975, back in Michigan, outside of Detroit. We're both suburb boys.
Not only Sam Raimi, but also John Cameron, right?
John Cameron, who now produces the Coen Brothers movie, and Rob Tappert, who then went on to produce the Xena and Hercules and shows like that.
So you guys were all high school buddies?
Almost all of us. Mm-hmm. There were about five of us that met between junior high. The guy who took the cover, the picture on the cover of the book, I met him in kindergarten. Uh-huh. And then I met other guys in junior high school who made little independent movies. I met Sam in high school. And by that point, it was sort of a neighborhood thing. I was doing little Super 8 movies in my neighborhood. Another buddy of mine was in his. Sam was in his. And then when you get to junior high, neighborhoods merge, you know. And I first saw Sam in eighth grade. He was dressed. This is the guy who directed Spider-Man. You know, he's sitting on the floor dressed as Sherlock Holmes playing with dolls. He claimed he was making a movie. I think he was just out of his tree. So I went way around. I remember specifically going across the hall, and then I didn't meet him officially for another couple of years because he was this freak kid. And so we started making movies together. Uh-huh. And what happened was they were all silly, very silly. Three Stooges, Marx Brothers, very derivative stuff. But then we thought, okay, high school's ended. What do we do for a job? We thought, well, maybe we could do this. Maybe we could do what we really have enjoyed. We didn't go to the prom. We didn't date. We didn't do any of that stuff. We just made Super 8 movies. It kept us out of a lot of trouble.
Well, what did you specialize in? Did you do camera, sound, or
well,
a bit of everything?
Well, I think because I was taller than most of the other guys and sort of had a square jaw, they went, "You, get in front of the camera." And we all did everything. But we really felt for the first movie, if we were going to get real money from real investors, we were afraid that in Detroit we would just get shut down if we didn't get them their money back. So what we did was we decided to make a no-holds-barred rock'em sock'em horror film, because in the industry, there's a certain amount of staples. You go into Blockbuster, you're going to have horror films. You're going to have comedies. You're going to have... So we wanted to make sure we could do a movie that would find a slot. But then on top of that, we tried to really take the gloves off and say, we don't want to get lost in the shuffle here. So Sam Raimi concocted this crazy story of five kids go to a cabin in the woods, find some cool stuff in the basement. Among that is some of the artifacts this professor dug up. It's a creepy tape. They play the tape, come across an incantation that he was reciting. They unleash this long dormant evil, and one by one they get possessed. So it's sort of an old-fashioned monster movie that we shot in Morristown, Tennessee in 1979.
I have this image of you and your buddies raising money in the Midwest for this film that came to be The Evil Dead. And you describe making cold calls to friends of friends and family, and that you screened this college horror film you made at dinner parties attended by dentists.
Oh, yeah, we went to one that was in particular. It was four dentists and their wives were getting together for a dinner party to watch this movie. That what we did is we made a Super 8 movie to show investors. It was called Within the Woods. It was a similar story. But it was horribly
of evil unleashed.
Same story, just a way shorter. Because we said this is a prototype. If you like this, the real movie will be way better.
Right.
And we ruined dinner after dinner. I mean, after they'd see it, they'd go, "Oh, I'll just have a cup of coffee." You know, we had one guy who invested who refused to see the movie. He says, "You can show this to my business partners. I don't like these movies. I don't understand them. They scare me. They make me sick. I don't know what your problem is, but I'll invest in it if my friends think it's good." He was happy he did because he made about over 10 times his money back.
Really?
All the
After
Evil
about
Dead
40 years, right?
They made 10 times their money back in 40 years. It took 6 years to break even.
Uh-huh. This is from The Evil Dead.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then finally, by making a sequel, it was one of these situations where the rights fee wound up putting us into profit.
They are funny. I mean, that's the whole point of a really great movie, B-movie.
Yeah.
It's a really good, bad movie. And
in a way, yeah, because what happened, Evil Dead is the first one, it's funny because it's a failed melodrama. The writing is very, you know, come on, we've got to bury Shelley. We can't bury Shelley. She's a friend of ours. You know, I mean, we're legitimately trying to say lines of dialogue like that the best that we could at the time. We had no reference points of what was funny, or we weren't trying to be funny. People always say, "Oh, that's such a campy movie." Yeah. The first one is not a campy movie. It's actors trying to figure out what the heck is going on.
Well, let's hear some from The Evil Dead. We have a clip. Now I'm going to do my best to explain what's going on here, and you can correct me. This scene is towards the end of the movie, and you, as Ash, and your friend. Actually, your friend has just been mauled by dead demon zombies.
This is a dark point in the movie. Things are bad for our hero.
Your friend is dying on the floor of the cabin.
He was the guy that the audience was really following. My character in the first Evil Dead movie is a very milquetoast, generic college kid. And then greatness is thrust upon him.
Exactly.
And this is a moment of crisis. You'll see he doesn't handle it very well.
The demons are surrounding the cabin. So
they're all over.
And that's basically all I could say. Here we go. Let's listen.
We're all going to die here.
No, we're not going to die.
We're all going to die. All of us.
No, we're not going to die.
We're not going to die. We're going to get out of here.
Now, listen to me, Scotty. Is there a way around the bridge?
Scotty, listen to me, please, for God's sake. Scott!
Come on.
Ash, I don't want to die. You're not going to leave me, are you, Ash? Are you?
I don't want to die. You're not going to leave me here, are you? Are you, Ash?
And those are the demons, right?
Yeah, a little trivia there for you. There's an eerie wind that you hear there, and throughout most of the movie, once things start to go really bad. Sam Raimi was awakened at about 3 o'clock in the morning by this sound coming through the window in where he was staying. We were all staying in the house together. He grabbed the sound man, went down the hallway, woke him up, said, "Come on, get your recorder." So they sat in there for about a half an hour getting this really creepy wind that was coming through a window. And that wound up being, I've heard it in other movies now.
Oh, it's been recycled.
Oh, yeah, sure, because it's a dead wind. It's a very constant, creepy presence, and it's good. And then there was a little grunting in there when I was trying to wake the guy back up into consciousness. That's Sam Raimi throwing in a few kind of, the actors were long gone, you know. We had to sort of finish this thing without them.
But you were laughing as we were listening to this clip.
I can't help it, yeah. The dialogue is so hokey and we're so bad at it. It's unbelievable. It's only later, Evil Dead 2 is considered someone coined a phrase, splatstick.
Well, yeah, there's a kind of Three Stooges-like quality to Evil Dead 2 where you have a certain satiric edge to the genre.
That was us getting more familiar with how to manipulate audiences and how to how to do this right. The first film is really a cruel, it's a cruel trick to be almost best known for your first work that you would rather shove under the table.
Bruce Campbell's memoir, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor, is out in paperback. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with actor Bruce Campbell. He starred in the Sam Raimi cult films The Evil Dead, The Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness. His memoir is If Chins Could Kill. Now, there were a number of things that Sam Raimi invented during this shoot that I think he continued to perfect over the course of his career.
Actually, to be fair, we actually all kind of kicked around a lot of these ideas.
Oh,
camera guys as well. Sam named them after himself.
The shaky cam. Now, that's the horror movie.
Yeah, shaky cam was a way to get the camera to be... Sam had a lot of shots that he needed of an evil entity, a disjointed point of view that was roaming through the woods. Mm-hmm. So he used a very wide-angle lens for that. And then pretty much concocted this scheme where you grab a 2x6 on either end, put the camera in the middle, and then you can raise it over bushes, and it's very...
Or you can just run like...
Yeah,
like
you can run like crazy, mm-hmm. Exactly. And you get really low to the ground. It was a pretty... It cost about $1.50, I think.
The Ramo cam.
See, what happens is Sam comes up with shots first, and then everyone goes, okay, how do we do this? There's two versions of it. It got higher budget as we got higher budget. The first Ramo cam was a guy with a piece of wood, with a T-shaped piece of wood, that he would run right behind the camera, and he hoped that he would smash the window with the board before the camera guy got there. But the gag is, while the camera guy is going through the window, I mean, broken glass is falling all over him. So it was like, well, that sort of worked, I guess. And then for Evil Dead 2, the camera had to go all the way through the back of a car. The camera had to start on the ground, come up to the car, break through the back windshield, go through the car, break through the front windshield, and keep going. And it wound up being this giant... By that point, we could afford a mechanical effects guy who could build stuff. And Sam said, here's a shot I want to do. And so they concocted this Ramo camera. It was a giant metal beam that it took about 5 or 6 of us to help. We had to run along with the camera, hoist it up, and then sort of funnel it through the car quickly. But on one take, we ran into the trunk. We destroyed the rearview mirror on another take. The mechanical effects guy had to blow the windows with a squib at just the right point. So at one point, we hit the window. It took us about 10 or more tries to get that.
A lot of your demons had white, or when the various characters would become demonized, their eyes would go from normal eyeballs to these white filmy
things.
That's
right, yeah. And the possessed look.
The possessed look, right, the back from the dead look. And apparently you used something called sclero contact.
Sclero lens, they were nasty. They cover your entire eye, and they're glass. And in 1979, there was no gas permeable, there was no soft lens of any kind. So they had to go in for sort of training. You had to pick up the top eyelid, shove it under, hold it under while you drag the bottom eyelid and hope to get under the lip and then put it up. And the actors had 15 minutes because then they had to get them out because your eye is not breathing during that 15-minute period.
So your eyeball could suffocate.
So you're blind and you can't see. And so what we would do is block out like 2 shots that we could get during that 15-minute period. Mm-hmm. And you can only do this 5 times a day. So it was really, we got to the point where we would just say, look, just close your eyes and we'll paint your eyelid white. And it worked just as well for shots that were further away that we didn't want to hassle with that stupid 15-minute thing.
And run with your eyes closed.
Oh, yeah, doing everything with your eyes closed. I had to fight this one actress, Betsy Baker's coming at me with a knife. And she can't see anything. And Sam's going, all right, you're really upset, see? I want you to really swing at him like you're going to get him. I'm like, okay, I'm glad this will be on film.
Now, do you know the recipe for fake blood by heart?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Easy. Karo syrup. Uh-huh. Clear Karo syrup. K-A-R-O. It's in your pancake aisle.
Well, sure, yeah. Pecan pie.
Yeah, you want to get that. Then you want to get those little bottles, actually the big bottles of red food coloring. They're a single bottle. Take all the red food coloring, dump it in there, shake it up, but then you'll notice that it's opaque. And you don't want that. That's too cheesy.
No, blood, you need something viscid and
yeah, blood. You have to make it opaque. It's too clear.
Right, it's too clear, yeah.
So we would take coffee creamer, like a Mr. Coffee, non-dairy. That's the best, 'cause you don't want it to spoil. It's all this fake stuff is really good for fake blood. So you mix it together into a paste. You have to use like warm water so it doesn't get lumpy. It's like a good pancake mixture. Uh-huh. Then you mix it in slowly and you have a nice opaqueness, but sometimes it can get pinkish red. So you take just a couple of drops of blue food coloring. It gives it a little bit of body. Don't go too crazy or you'll start getting purple.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's an art to this.
Then you test it. Uh-huh. You mix it all up. You test it on a white porcelain sink, like your bathtub or something. Just let it drip down and you'll see. You can test the color. It works great.
Kind but of
it
a attracts, psycho test.
Yeah, it attracts flies. But you know what? It's actually better and way cheaper than that crappy stage blood you buy at your local Spencer's Gifts or whatever.
Well, you must have emptied out every grocery store in Tennessee.
Oh, and it's small. Well, what was very embarrassing, though, is a lot of special effects guys use KY jelly.
Mm.
They use all these lubricants. And in many cases, these poor guys have to go into towns and they buy boxes of condoms because those are blood bladders. They use them as balloon type things.
To explode. So what does this feel like on you as an actor when you're covered in this stuff?
It becomes really candy-like. It is. It's the basis for candy. So
how about when it dries?
My shirt would stick to me. It would stick completely to every hair in my body. So I'd go to stretch and just rip out a whole shank of hair. I'd walk home and just go right into the shower. We had a white pickup truck that didn't stay white for very long that we rented, that we destroyed. And I'd sit in the back of it coming home from the shoot. We would shoot all night long, and then I'd come home at 6 o'clock in the morning, or sometimes one morning was a Sunday morning. People were out going to church, and I looked like a serial killer in the back of this pickup truck kind of waving to people. Because it was the only way to do it. No one would let me in their car. And so we'd start the shower. I just would walk right in with the clothes on because it had to melt the Karo syrup off it.
Bruce Campbell's memoir is If Chins Could Kill. It's now out in paperback. Billy Guy, an original member of the Coasters Quartet, died this week at the age of 66 of heart disease. The Coasters were one of the first black singing groups to break out of the rhythm and blues category into rock and roll. They were among the first artists to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when it opened in 1987. Guy stood out as the humorous baritone of the group, whose hits included Yakety Yak and Charlie Brown. Here's Billy Guy singing the lead in the Coasters' 1957 hit, Searchin'.
Gonna find her.
Coasters with their 1957 hit, Searchin'. Coming up, a review of the new film, Far From Heaven. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Far From Heaven is the new film written and directed by Todd Haynes, whose other films include Safe, Poison, and Velvet Goldmine. Set in the 50s, Far From Heaven stars Julianne Moore as an upper-middle-class housewife, Dennis Quaid as her husband, and Dennis Hasbert as the black gardener Moore turns to when her marriage is in trouble. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It's no big news that soap operas have historically peddled complacency with the social order, especially when it comes to the role of women. But in the 50s, when German émigré Douglas Sirk made a series of so-called women's pictures like Magnificent Obsession and All That Heaven Allows, he managed to deliver three hanky weepers that hinted subversively at the ways in which many women's lives were circumscribed. A lot of gay men related to the heroines of those movies, whose love dared not speak its name, and they liked the lush decor, too. Still, when I heard that the next project of the great gay, semiotics-oriented writer-director Todd Haynes would be a Sirk-style soap opera called Far From Heaven, it sounded like a recipe for camp. And Haynes had already been over this terrain. In his brilliant 1995 film Safe, Julianne Moore played a pretty housewife who was like a canary in the coal mines of the 80s, poisoned by the era's sterile conformity and other toxins. What more did Haynes have to say? The answer is not much, but in Far From Heaven, he says it more passionately, and the upshot is a movie that makes everything else on our screens look anemic. The setting is Hartford, Connecticut, in 1956, when it was a waspy enclave of insurance companies and modern corporations like Magnatech. That's where Frank Whitaker, played by Dennis Quaid, is an executive. He and his model wife, Kathy, played by Julianne Moore, are even known as Mr. and Mrs. Magnatech. Appearances deceive, though. Frank carries a dark secret. He's a homosexual. When Kathy eventually finds him in a lip lock with another man, she doesn't know how to process it. It's not something one speaks of openly, and the marriage threatens to implode. Here's a scene from a cocktail party at the Whitakers. Frank is drunk, Kathy is desperate to keep him from drinking more, and things appear on the verge of getting ugly.
Oh, by golly, there she is now, the prettiest gal in the room.
Oh, Stan, liquor brings out the Texan in you. I hope Eleanor isn't listening.
So what if she is? I still say Frank is the luckiest guy in town.
Hear, hear. It's all smoke and mirrors, fellas. That's all it is. You should see her without her face on.
Frank? No, he's absolutely right. We ladies are never what we appear, and every girl has her secrets.
I'll say.
How about this girl going and getting her husband another drink?
Darling, don't you think you've already had
it? No, I don't think I've had
it. I'd just like to take a moment to raise a glass to our marvelous host and hostess and another glorious annual party at the Whitakers. To Frank and Kathy. Truly, Mr. and Mrs. Magnatech.
It says something about Haynes's inner world that he doesn't really empathize with a closeted homosexual of his parents' generation. The movie's only heartfelt relationship is between Kathy and the family's Negro lawn and garden tender, Raymond Deegan, played by Dennis Haysbert, who in 2002 can be the president of the U.S. in the TV series 24. Julianne Moore is uncanny. She gets the externals right, the wardrobe, the makeup, all the cheerful 50s artifice. But she also shows you how Kathy chose them. You see a woman playing a part, playing it with determination and almost military precision. Then you see how Kathy is imprisoned by that role and chafes under it and can't transcend it. The 60s, as we think of them, wouldn't be for another decade, and there is no other design for living, not then, not with kids, not in Hartford. In the end, we're still in a 50s women's picture. The genius of Far From Heaven is how it hits you viscerally. The romance and the dread are all mixed up. Through composition, camera movement, and color, Haynes communicates how culturally shackled these people are. I don't think there's an image in this entire widescreen movie that hasn't been worked out. The colors of each autumn leaf, the swish of Kathy's skirt, the maraschino cherries in the daiquiris the ladies drink over lunch when everyone but Kathy confesses to their husband's sexual appetites. The movie is engineered to within an inch of its life, but that inch is bursting with feeling. It never seems over-controlled, mostly because you can always sense the helplessness of the characters beneath their costumes and poses. Haynes hasn't just reproduced the conventions of Cirque movies. He maintains an almost erotic fixation on the textures of 50s middlebrow culture. He has gone so deep into his own attraction to these films that he has fetishized them. It's hard to think of a movie so ironic and at the same time so emotionally overflowing. What could have been a postmodern exercise for film students expands in your head and becomes a lament for all our cultural shackles. And something else. It's a hell of a good soap opera.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Another notable member of the 50s music scene passed away this month, Billy Mitchell. He died on November 5th at the age of 71 of cancer. Mitchell was one of the founding members of the doo-wop group The Clovers. We'll close now with Billy Mitchell singing the lead on the Coasters' 1959 hit, Love Potion No. 9.
I took my troubles down to Madame Ruth. You know that gypsy with the gold cap tooth. She's got a pad on 34th and Vine, selling little bottles of Love Potion No. 9. I told her that I was a flop with chicks. I've been this way since 1956. She looked at my palm and she made a magic sign. She said, what you need is Love Potion No. 9. She bent down and turned around and gave me a wink. She said, I'm gonna mix it up right here in the sink. It smelled like turpentine and looked like India ink. I held my nose, I closed my eyes,
I took a drink.
I didn't know it was a day or night. I started kissing everything in sight. But when I kissed a cop at 34th and Vine, he broke my little bottle of Love Potion No. 9.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Book Magazine. In the current issue, editors pick their best of 2002, books, titles, and characters, in bookstores or at 800-317-2665. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Spider-Man is now out on video. On the next Fresh Air, Stan Lee tells us about creating Spider-Man 40 years ago. Lee was the leading creative force behind the rise of Marvel Comics and is responsible for many of the Marvel Universe heroes, including the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, and the Incredible Hulk. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Very good.